You're here this morning. We bid you welcome who come with weary spirit, seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. Please refer to the announcements in the order of service. Our offertory music is not in the order of service today. Matt Meals will be our pianist, Chopin, Etude Opus 25, number 1.
Aeolian harp.
Thank you. Aeolian harp. We now light the chalice. Elena, please come up front. Thank you. We light this chalice in memory of the courage of those who have struggled for freedom, the perseverance of those who have struggled for justice, and the love of those who have built beloved communities to carry on the light of hope. Our opening hymn is number 131, Love Will Guide Us. Children, please come forward. Catherine Colburn will read the story of all ages. Where is Catherine? I know she is here. I've seen her already. So, how are you all this morning?
Yeah.
Good. Good. Anybody has a cold? But I hope you will have a good start of your week not being sick. Catherine will read you a story about the Harlem Renaissance. Does anybody know what the Harlem Renaissance is? Maybe some of the older students? Oh, you do?
Renaissance.
Renaissance Festival? That is right. The Renaissance Festival has a connection with it, but here is Catherine.
Hello? Hello? Sorry, I'm late to the party. Can anybody tell me what our theme of the month we've been talking about is, Jake? Perseverance, yeah. I heard you guys talking a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance Party, right? You guys, did Elka just talk about that? Yes, maybe. No? Okay, well, our story today is about the Harlem Renaissance. And this was a party that was about 100 years ago in Harlem. And that's a place. Does anybody know where Harlem is? Ronan? It's in New York, yeah. And the Harlem Renaissance. Oh, yeah, I would love to go to New York. It seems like a really cool place. Virginia? It wasn't in Renaissance time, like the Renaissance Fair. Great question. Well, the Harlem Renaissance was all about black people and their contributions to the arts. What were some of the, what do we include in the arts? What are some things that we include as art? Rose?
Music.
Music. Definitely, there was tons of music. Ronan? She steal yours? Jake?
Dancing.
Yeah, dancing. Virginia?
Pictures of beautiful things like flowers,
Nick. Theater, yeah.
The obvious painting.
The paintings, yes. Jake, last one.
Could also be music.
Yeah, definitely music. And another one is literature, like stories and poems. And we're going to learn why they called it the Harlem Renaissance in this story. I promise they'll answer your question, Virginia. Well, that's a good question, too. African Americans have lots of different skin tones. Not everybody is the same color to be included in black people, so they can have light or dark skin. And the Harlem Renaissance is a great example of perseverance because it's black people, and they were persevering through this time of racism and prejudice to make contributions to the arts. So we're going to learn about a boy, Lonnie, and he got to go and meet lots of famous people from the Harlem Renaissance. Do any of you know where Lawrence, Kansas is? The most, yeah, Lawrence, Kansas? It's Lawrence, Kansas. It's past Topeka, but it's really close to here. And one of the most famous Harlem Renaissance poets and writers was Langston Hughes, and he grew up in Lawrence. Griffin. There is a Renaissance festival in Lawrence. It's a fun one, too. Well, this little boy in this story is black. He just has a lighter skin tone. Virginia?
Oh, I've heard of that before, where blacks almost look white, but their skin is just really, really light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, blacks can have really, really light skin, too. All right, come one, come all to a party today in Harlem. Celebrate the great men and women of the Harlem Renaissance. Everyone, everywhere is invited. It all began with a great big message written across the sky. Oh, can we go, Uncle Bates? I pleaded. Now who can resist a party and an invitation written in the sky, said Uncle Bates. Come on, Lonnie, we have a plane to catch. They're going to the Harlem Renaissance party. People from all over the world were rushing to get tickets to Harlem. Will my favorite poet, Langston Hughes, be there? It wouldn't be a party, Lonnie, without Langston, said Uncle Bates. As soon as our plane took off, Uncle Bates got talking with that proud look on his face. Lonnie, he said, we'll see musicians, poets, novelists, painters, activists, philosophers, and scholars, wise men and women, giants standing tall above the crowd, sharing dreams of a better life for black people. In no time, we were walking on 7th Avenue with the giants of the Harlem Renaissance. Just like Uncle Bates said, I could hear the drum beats of a parade blocks away. Uncle Bates! I cried. I know, Lonnie, he said. A parade is coming, but let's eat breakfast first. Wells Restaurant has the best fried chicken and waffles this side of Haven. We're meeting my friend Jack here. Have you guys ever had chicken and waffles before?
Yeah.
They're really good. Hi, Jack. Called Uncle Bates. Meet my nephew, Lonnie. Tell him how it feels to be Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world. It feels great, Lonnie. As great as eating fried chicken and waffles smothered with hot buttered syrup. Dig in. After we eat, we'll look for Langston, your favorite poet. Mm-mm. Breakfast was so good. While we ate, all kinds of people, and giants too, came by to say hello to the champ and meet Uncle Bates and me. Being with a champ made me feel like I was a champ too. We stepped outside just in time to catch catch the Marcus Garvey parade. The great leader looked like an African king, all dressed in purple with gold tassels and braids on his jacket. Everyone was cheering wildly and waving Garvey flags. Yes, Virginia. Yeah, purple was the color of royalty, and this guy looked like a royal African king.
My name is Violet.
But when Marcus Garvey began to speak, you could hear a pin drop. I stand before you, a proud black man, honored to be a black man, who would be nothing else in God's creation but a black man. I want you to feel the same. The crowd roared. The celebration was on. I bet there was lots of whistling. Uncle Bates said W.E.B. Du Bois at the Crisis Magazine will know where we can find Langston. There's not much Dr. Du Bois doesn't know, said Jack. He was the first black person to get the doctorate, to get a doctorate from Harvard, and he was the founder of the NAACP. If brains could box, he'd be the champ. Jack danced around, throwing a few punches in the air. W.E.B., said Jack, my friend Lonnie wants to be a writer like you and Langston. I want to be creative, like the writers and the artists during the Harlem Renaissance, I said. Yes, said Dr. Du Bois. We black folk had a new desire to create, as though we had just awakened from a deep, deep sleep. Is that why we call it the Harlem Renaissance, I asked. That's it exactly, said Dr. Du Bois. Now go find Langston. So that's why they called it the Harlem Renaissance, because they had been suppressed for a really long time, and so they all woke up and they said, we want to create, just like in the Renaissance time, there was a new push for lots of different arts. So Lonnie and his uncle, they go searching for Mr. Langston Hughes, and they meet all kinds of people. They meet musicians, and they meet artists, and they get to meet Madam C.J. Walker at her beauty school, and they just keep searching, and everybody's kind of pointing them in the direction of Langston Hughes. And they meet some actresses, and they say, hey, we're going to see Langston right now. You want to come with us? So they walk in to this Schomburg library, and Zora Neale Hurston had just finished reading a story from Mules and Men, her collection of Negro folktales. The crowd roared with laughter. Then, Lonnie, I hear a soft voice repeating the words, my people, my people. It was Langston Hughes reading my favorite poem. I whispered along. My people, dream singers, storytellers, dancers, loud laughers in the hands of fate. This is Langston Hughes at the Schomburg. So he gets to see him. He's been searching for this poet that he loves. It's from Lawrence, Kansas. And he finally finds him. When I finally had a chance to talk with Mr. Hughes, I almost forgot what I was going to say. My name is Lonnie, Mr. Hughes, and I would like to know where you get your ideas for your poems. I get my ideas from jazz, the blues. I get my ideas from my people, said Mr. Hughes. Do you write, Mr. Lonnie? Yes, I guess so, I said. Then you are a writer, said Mr. Hughes. I went away feeling like a giant. Carter G. Woodson was in the audience, too. Mr. Woodson, I said, you started Negro History Week. Now it's Black History Month. I want to thank you for that. You're quite welcome, Lonnie, said Mr. Woodson. So he's getting to meet all these really famous people that did really important stuff for the black community. On the street, people were rushing into the Savoy Ballroom. Come on, you all, feel like dancing? Let's show Johnny how to cut a rug, said Uncle Bates. A man in tattered clothes said, not everybody's dressed up, but everybody is welcome, just as long as they can dance. Someone said, say that again, man, and everybody hummed. Mm-hmm. So there's the dancing. More of that art. Miss Mills and Miss Baker were the first ones to take the floor. Come on, little Lonnie, let us grown folks show you how to do the Charleston and the Foxtrot. The party was really getting hot. Fletcher Henderson's band was playing Tuxedo Junction, and Louis Armstrong was on the trumpet. And Coleman Hawkins was on the saxophone. All the giants were dancing up a storm. We danced and danced till I got sleepy. Yeah, Virginia?
What do they mean,
giants? Giants. So it's all these really important people. So they're calling all the important people of the Harlem Renaissance giants because they held a really big presence in the room. They were probably pretty big, especially compared to Lonnie, since Lonnie's good.
Time to go home, Lonnie, said Uncle Bates. Can we do this again? I asked. Lonnie, a party like this happens only once in a lifetime, but you will always remember meeting the giants, said Uncle Bates. I hugged all my new friends. Keep dancing, they said. Langston Hughes said, don't ever forget you're a writer, Mr. Lonnie. We headed for home, but the party was still going strong in Harlem. Uncle Bates, now I know why the Harlem Renaissance is so important. Why, Lonnie? Because black people didn't come to America to be free. We fought for our freedom by creating art, music, literature, and dance. Now, everywhere you look, you find a piece of our freedom, Uncle Bates said. Like Marcus Garvey, I am so proud to be a black. One day, I will be a famous writer, just like Langston Hughes, you see, Uncle Bates. And I said, I learned from the giants of the Harlem Renaissance. That night, I had a dream that I was still at the Harlem Renaissance party, only I was a famous writer at my very own poetry reading. Langston Hughes and all the artists and writers were there. Alan Locke brought an African mask. Aunt Connie and Uncle Bates were there with Jack Johnson. I was the proudest little giant of the Harlem Renaissance. The end.
Offering is an important part of our fellowship. UUFM is supported by the voluntary generosity of all who join with us. The offering will now be given and received in grateful appreciation. If you have a joy or concern, you may put it into the offertory baskets. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. That was beautiful. The poet says that joy and woe is woven fine, but this morning we have mostly joy overflowing, if what people have reported is any reflection of our truths. Maeve Tenona says that she just got back from a week-long mission trip in Haiti with her mom, which means Kathleen also just got back from a week-long mission trip. They went with the Manhattan Medical Missions and were able to perform surgeries for free on many Haitians. So we're appreciative that you went and represented us so well, and glad to have you back. We're also glad to have Michaela here today, back from break after her second trimester, says her dad and Dixie. And I'm just going to say it's good to see Wayne Clark, who has had a number of medical issues, but I'm so glad he's back here with us today. And finally, Michael Oldfather offers that almost every place I go, I feel like an outsider, but not here. Thank you.
Imagine for a minute that you are a woman in an era of gender bias and male dominance, where sexual harassment and exploitation are condoned and accepted, where you know that if you report sexual abuse, it is you, not the perpetrator, who will be punished. Now imagine that you are black or brown with your neck under the boot of Jim Crow. Or imagine that you were born into economic deprivation in a world with no social safety net. Imagine that you are a man trapped in a woman's body at a time when LGBT people were condemned, vilified, and shunned. Pauli Murray was all of the above. Four strikes against her before she even stepped into the batter's box. Pauli Murray's mother dropped dead of a massive stroke when Pauli was 3 years old. Her father was racked with grief, poverty, and illness, was unable to care for his six children, all under the age of 10. The bank foreclosed on their house. Shortly after her mother's sudden death, Pauli's father suffered a complete mental breakdown, was hauled off to the Maryland State Hospital for the Negro Insane, a dismal, filthy institution where he was savagely beaten to death, his skull crushed with a baseball bat wielded by a brutal white guard. Pauli Murray, poor, black, now a little orphan girl, orphan boy, really, trapped by some strange trick of providence inside the body of a girl. With the deck thus stacked against her, proceeded to bravely take on every single obstacle she faced, one by one, defiant, resolute, persevering. Even as a child, she showed her mettle and moral courage, moral outrage. She refused to ride in segregated streetcars. She walked instead. She boycotted movie theaters rather than submit to banishment to the blacks-only balconies. She refused to wear girls' clothing. She refused to accept her feminine given name, Pauline, and named herself Pauli. Her aunt indulged her boyish ways, except on Sunday. You can be a boy girl at home, but not at Episcopal Church. Pauli Murray graduated from high school at age 15, the top student in her class, editor of the school newspaper, president of the literary society, class secretary, member of the debate club, forward on the basketball team. She worked her way through Hunter College in New York City, where she embraced radical politics in the labor and civil rights movements. In 1938, she applied to the University of North Carolina Graduate School at Chapel Hill, knowing it was whites only, and tried unsuccessfully to recruit the NAACP to help her sue for integration. 13 years later, society caught up to Pauli, and the university was finally integrated. In 1940, 15 years before Rosa Parks, Pauli refused to move to the back of a bus traveling from Richmond, Virginia to Durham, North Carolina. She was thrown in jail. This time, the NAACP did take on the case to challenge the constitutionality of segregated interstate travel. But the state of Virginia, in order to evade her challenge to segregation, charged Pauli only with disorderly conduct. Having failed to integrate the University of North Carolina, she entered Howard Law School in Washington, D.C. and was met with blatant sex discrimination and ridicule from both the all-male faculty and the all-male student body. Her response was to graduate first in her otherwise all-male class. She then applied to Harvard Law School for graduate work and was told no women allowed. After that rejection, she coined the term Jane Crow to describe the double whammy of gender and racial bias and went instead to Berkeley, where she earned a Master of Law degree. She wrote a 750-page book entitled States' Laws on Race and Color, which thoroughly exposed the extent and barbarism of legally sanctioned segregation in America. Thurgood Marshall called her book the Bible of Brown versus Board of Education. She served on John F. Kennedy's Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. She became the first African-American ever to earn a Doctor of the Science of Law degree from Yale. She argued sex discrimination cases in court, including a successful challenge to the use of sex and race discrimination in jury selection in Alabama. She co-founded the National Organization for Women with Betty Friedan. Then at the age of 62, she baffled her friends by resigning a tenured professorship at Brandeis so that she could move to New York and enroll in the theological seminary in preparation for the Episcopal priesthood. Why on earth did she do that? Simple. Because the Episcopal Church, which had always been her church, forbade the ordination of women. At age 67, she became the first black woman priest in the history of the Episcopal Church. All this and much more from a determined little boy girl who had four strikes against her before she even stepped into the batter's box. Here are a few lines from Pauli Murray's poem entitled Prophecy. I have been enslaved, yet my spirit is unbound. I have been cast aside, but I sparkle in the darkness. I have been slain, but I live on in the river of history.
I invite you to join in our hymn number 350, The Ceaseless Flow of Endless Time. Witness in the last couple of weeks to unexpected players entering the arena of gun control debate. Teenagers from Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. They'd faced or hidden from an armed invader, another teen, not too unlike themselves, someone who had attended classes at the same school. 17 people, teens, and their teachers did not survive. And then some of the survivors decided that no one else should ever face the situation they found themselves in. With the increasing routineness of school shootings, who could imagine that? Never again, we cynical or realistic adults hardened by what we have witnessed time after time, would not have dared to put that label on a group opposing gun violence. Never again. These are teenagers, though, still idealistic. They're not elected or appointed leaders. They have no authority, no power, no position. They're not even grown-ups. They're not even the cool kids. Most of the leaders of the Never Again movement came from the drama club. Cameron Caskey, who thought up the Never Again name, and you've probably seen on TV or heard on the radio, has been labeled a talkative class clown. Another leader, Jacqueline Corin, had done a project on gun control for her AP composition and rhetoric class, but had never done any political activism. They are outside the system, not connected with elected officials or lobbyists or nonprofit organizations. They are outsiders. And this is only one of the movements that's afoot these days of outsiders. Black Lives Matter, the Women's March, the record number of women and people of color running for local and national office. Outsiders, like Pauli Murray was, like the artists of the Harlem Renaissance were, like many successful change agents have been, outsiders. And according to Malcolm Gladwell in his book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, the outsider may have some unexpected advantages, including the rarely recognized advantage of not doing things the way others are expecting them to be done, being unconventional. So first, what do I mean by being an outsider? There are different possibilities, and I like them all. Someone may be an outsider because of personal characteristics or identity, any of the standard characteristics that lead to discrimination, race, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, ethnic background, religion, disability, age, class, any difference from the majority or from those who have the power to make decisions. Other things, too, can make someone an outsider. Perhaps a life experience has changed them. Or a choice sets them apart from the larger culture. Maybe the early loss of a parent, or surviving cancer at a young age, or the decision to remain unmarried or not to have children. Maybe living off the grid or moving from one culture or nation to another. A wide variety of experiences and choices can make someone feel outside of and apart from the larger culture in which they live. And I'm going to make a claim here that some people might disagree with. Unitarian Universalists are outsiders. Most of us chose to be UUs, leaving some other religious affiliation to do so, or finding something missing in the secular life that brought us here. Even born and raised UUs recognize that their world view is not widely shared. Our religion includes such a microscopic sliver of the population. If you use the highest possible polling estimates of our numbers in the U.S., which are much higher than our actual membership numbers, then less than 2 people in 1,000 identify as UU. That's a pretty tiny minority. And yet 4 of our presidents have been Unitarian, 5 if you count Jefferson, whose Unitarian ideas never led him to any actual affiliation. And we count many prominent people as ours. Some would point out how that shows the privilege with which many Unitarians and Universalists have lived. It might also indicate, though, how well the persistence of the outsider can work. Before I go on to illustrations, though, I need to acknowledge that this outsider business cuts both ways. You know, the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. We have a small sign on our bookcase at home that my partner Jane's sister-in-law gave Jane after she had a run-in with a bear while hiking. It says, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, except bears. Bears kill you." So some stuff really does kill or cripple or emotionally wound you so that you can't go on. And outsiders are often victims of such things. Gladwell describes many of the opportunities that the outsider has, but I don't want to diminish the negative side of psychological effects of being an outsider. For example, there are at least two very different populations, where people with learning disabilities are overrepresented: in prison and among successful entrepreneurs. It's correlation, not causation for sure. It's interesting, though, that two such different groups, one very unsuccessful and one very successful, both have more people with learning disabilities. One form of outsider. So outsiders can succeed or fail. They can be broken by the system, by the tyrannies and accidents of life, or by deliberate and willful oppression. But just because you're an outsider, it doesn't mean you have to be broken. Outsiders may find ways to survive and thrive and even change the world so that it better suits them. And they do have some characteristics that might help in doing that. First, outsiders see things that others do not see, or see them in a way that others fail to. Pauli Murray, for example, saw an unorthodox way to challenge segregation, to directly attack Plessy v. Ferguson and get it overturned. Other legal scholars were saying that's not the route to do it. But she saw that. More conventional thinkers couldn't believe that would work, and it did. So less conventional thinking allows outsiders to develop skills that others don't have. They can live better with uncertainty. They find their identity in themselves rather than outside themselves through acceptance from others. They know how to get up when they've been knocked down. Outsiders often experience events that leave them stronger. A common experience of outsiders is that they have faced and overcome adversity. Pauli Murray certainly illustrated that. From being orphaned to suffering under Jim Crow and what she called Jane Crow, her strength seemed to grow as she overcame one barrier after another. And it's surprising how many people who come through terrible adversity, really, really terrible adversity, will shrug their shoulders and say, "It could have been worse." They have perspective. Gladwell contends that people who come through hard times and survive sometimes begin to believe that nothing can stop them. Of course, if you think you've already seen the worst, you may know you can handle the small stuff. People reject outsiders. That's practically the definition of outsider. And writer Carolyn Gregor advises people who want to persevere to reject rejection. That is, when someone says no, refuse to accept that. Outsiders are often rejected. They know the sting of that, and they keep going. One of the classic UU stories is of the Universalist minister Olympia Brown. How many people know of Olympia Brown? Just a few, okay. She was ordained in 1863, one of the first women in the country, if not the first, to achieve that honor. And she had been rejected by one seminary after another. Biographer Laurie Carter Noble writes of Brown's experience. "The Unitarian School of Meadville, Pennsylvania, replied to her request for admission, saying that the trustees thought it would be too great an experiment to admit a woman. Oberlin, replied that she could be admitted but could not participate in public exercises. Finally, Ebenezer Fisher, president of the Universalist Divinity School at St. Lawrence University, offered her admission but added that he did not think women were called to the ministry, but I leave that between you and the great head of the church. This, Olympia thought, was exactly where it should be left. But when I arrived, I was told I had not been expected and that Mr. Fisher had said I would not come, as he had written so discouragingly to me. I had supposed his discouragement was my encouragement. She rejected the rejection of others, being encouraged instead of discouraged by their words. This determination, writes Noble, characterized her throughout her long and fruitful life. Olympia Brown survived in her ministry in Bridgeport, Connecticut, though people agitated about her maternity leave. And then she took on a church in Racine, Wisconsin, that described itself as adrift, in debt, hopeless, and doubtful. That's how it described itself. She revived that church, and it carries her name today, the Olympia Brown Unitarian Universalist Church. She wrote in her autobiography, "Those who may read this will think it strange that I could only find a field in rundown or comatose churches, but they must remember that the pulpits of all the prosperous churches were already occupied by men and were looked forward to as the goal of all the young men coming into the ministry with whom I, at first the only woman preacher in the denomination, had to compete. All I could do was take some place that had been abandoned by others and make something of it, and this I was only too glad to do. Outsiders can succeed where insiders would be too intimidated to try. Outsiders will take on chores that insiders might disdain and often can pull it off because they have exactly the determination needed to do it." So being ordained and being a minister was not enough, though, for Olympia Brown. She also fought tirelessly for the right of suffrage for women. At age 53, she decided to devote herself to the cause. She toured Kansas, preaching off the back of wagons, and burned Woodrow Wilson's speeches in front of the White House. In the end, she was one of the few 19th century suffragists who lived long enough to vote in an election. Gladwell talks about how outsiders who are innovative and revolutionary have a pattern of personality traits that includes being disagreeable. Not obnoxious or rude, simply unwilling to take no for an answer. They're willing to raise their voice. They don't care whether other people agree with them or not. They're not captive to popular opinion. Or as comedian John Oliver put it, "I'm used to people not liking me." You saw it in Polly Murray and Olympia Brown. And in those students from Parkland, Florida, they care less about being perceived positively than they do about accomplishing their goals. And outsiders, at their best, form community of others like them, communities of resistance, to help accomplish those goals. Maya Angelou described how she and her black friends, including James Baldwin, who she calls Jimmy, got through after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. There was very little serious conversation. The times were so solemn and the daily news so somber that we snatched mirth from unlikely places and gave servings of it to one another with both hands. I told Jimmy I was so glad to laugh. Jimmy said, "We survived slavery. You know how we survived? We put surviving into our poems and into our songs. We put it into our folk tales. We danced surviving in Congo Square in New Orleans and put it in our pots when we cooked pinto beans. We knew if we wanted to survive, we had better lift our spirits. So we laughed whenever we got the chance. So I find three important things in that quote. One, they came together. Both the black friends in the 1960s and the slaves a century or two earlier. The community supported one another. They were not alone and isolated. Second, they laughed. In the face of discouragement and even danger, they laughed. We had better lift our own spirits, Baldwin said. And finally, they used art. Poems and songs and dancing and cooking, the arts of community, the arts of the Harlem Renaissance. As African-American poet Lucille Clifton wrote, "Won't you celebrate with me that I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and failed." And that relates to more advice that Carolyn Grigor gives for perseverance. Fully experience both positive and negative emotions. I think this one is tough. It's easy enough to experience the positive, but the negative hurts so much. Somehow it often requires the balance of the two to stick it out, though. African-American inspirational writer Margaret Wheatley quotes a Zimbabwean woman, "In my grief, I saw myself being held, us all holding one another in this incredible web of loving kindness. Grief and love in the same place. I felt as if my heart would burst with holding it all." The movie Lion that came out a year or so ago tells the story of Saru, a 5-year-old Indian boy who wanders onto a decommissioned train and ends up days later in Kolkata, a world away from the village where his mother works moving rocks and his older brother teaches him to steal coal to sell for milk. I don't know a better story of perseverance than this story. After months on the street and in an orphanage, he's adopted by a Tasmanian couple, so different racially, culturally, and economically from his family of origin, but sharing the same love he had known there. As a young man, when he sets out to find his lost family, he works through grief and guilt, but is driven by love and loyalty. And the full experience of the positive and negative feelings gives him the perseverance he needs to accomplish a seemingly impossible task. Often, though, outsiders persist only because they have nothing to lose. They can play the trickster, they can break the rules, and this works because, as Gladwell says, there comes a time when the best-intentioned application of power and authority begins to backfire. Whether it's the revulsion felt nationwide by the photo of a dog coming at a teenager in Bull Connor's Birmingham, or the image of the tank in Tiananmen Square up against a single protester, the shootings of unarmed black men by police, or the arrests of suffragist women protesting outside the White House. Other people begin to recognize the misuse, overreach, or abuse of power and to side with the outsiders. Gladwell describes the resistance of the town Le Chabon, the French town that sheltered Jews, including hundreds of Jewish children during World War II. all under the nose of the Vichy government. It was not the privileged and fortunate who took in the Jews in France, he writes. It was the marginal and the damaged. The town had a history of resistance because it was primarily made up of Huguenots, religious misfits in Catholic France. And when the Nazis tried to start a Hitler youth camp there, even the youth were clear. They wrote a letter that they presented directly to a Vichy official when he came to visit. And the letter said, "We feel obliged to tell you that there are among us a certain number of Jews. But we make no distinction between Jews and non-Jews. It is contrary to the gospel teaching. If our comrades, whose only fault is to be born in another religion, received the order to let themselves be deported or even examined, they would disobey the order they received, and we would try to hide them as best we could. We have Jews. You're not getting them." The town stood together. The force that the government would have to use against them was more than the Vichy government could stomach. The people of the town received anonymous warnings when planned raids were going to happen. Officials coming to investigate would take long coffee breaks in the town before beginning their work. And meanwhile, despite some arrests and persecution, the people of Le Chabon found strength in one another, in their commitment to what they understood of the gospel, and in the stories of their persecuted Huguenot ancestors. Edouard Theis, one of the clergy there, after being released from an internment camp, smuggled Jews across the Alps to Switzerland. He said, "It was not reasonable, but you know, I had to do it anyway." Gladwell says, "Wiping out a town or a people or a movement is never as simple as it looks. The powerful are not as powerful as they seem, nor the weak as weak. The powerful are not as powerful as they seem, or the weak as weak." Perhaps the National Rifle Association is not as powerful as it seems to be. Perhaps it will be revealed as the lobbying group for gun manufacturers willing to sacrifice lives for profits. Perhaps it will become too negatively perceived to be associated with. Delta and United Airlines, Hertz, MetLife, Simon Tech, Best Western, the First National Bank of Omaha, and a bunch of other corporations have ended contracts with the NRA. And losing those kind of ties might not matter to outsiders, but it's really important to people in power. And for many people who are not used to not being liked, the perceptions matter, and those perceptions certainly matter to politicians. Cameron Caskey from Never Again says, "The only thing I've had this whole time is the fact that I never shut up." That's an asset, yet he does have more. He has the strength of community, a community of support that seems to grow every day. He has the idealism, the unconventional thinking, to believe that the conventional political calculus has changed. He and his fellow teens have the skills with social media that people my age covet. And like so many other outsiders, he and his friends have lived through the unimaginable, the unbelievable. The toughest moment of their lives, of their young lives, may be behind them. And that can make people a lot braver than they imagined they can be. I think we have about 10 minutes if we have thoughts from other people about perseverance, about the outsiders, about the issue of gun control as it's coming to us now, or anything else that is in your mind. It looks like Jean is getting the microphone together. Maybe. Ha. All right. Hands.
I was struck by some other examples of outsiders. I mean, Albert Einstein had a 9-to-5 job when he was doing this work on relativity and existence of atoms and photoelectric effect and all that. And then I got rather discouraged because I'm not an Einstein. I'm not an Olympia Brown. I didn't graduate far from... I graduated very far from being number one in my class. And so these super people are hard to emulate. And so I really appreciated your examples of the Huguenot folks and the kids in Florida and the folks who just say, I'm going to be myself, which then reminded me of a physicist hero of mine, Richard Feynman, one of a marvelous book called What Do You Care What Other People Think? that was a slogan between him and his first wife. Anyway, thanks for the examples of ordinary people's perseverance in being themselves and
Hello, Fred Reynolds. I just wanted to mention that I am an outsider at work where no one believes like I do. So every time I go to work, I either have to keep my mouth shut or let people know I disagree with them. But yeah, I'm an outsider and always have been. I was an outsider at school, so... I guess that's what I wanted to say.
I really enjoyed your reflection today, and I think being an outsider is a type of superpower that we all have because it enables us to do what needs to be done without really caring what other people think. And I think that's a power because trying to fit within the normal box is... I think how quote-unquote normal society tries to keep everything in order, and it's the outsiders that can make the difference because we don't care.
We have several teachers at Manhattan High School who served in the military for 20 years, and then they became public school teachers. They vehemently speak out against arming teachers in the classroom. Even so, they would be the ones that would be targeted because they served in the military, have experience with using guns and such, and they are vehemently against it. And I think teachers and students will really work together and walk out together as this whole issue comes more to the forefront. So I don't think teachers want to be put in very dangerous positions right now.
On a fairly regular course of my life, I'm present with people who say absolutely stupid things and immoral attacks. It's just awful, and I rarely say anything. And I don't know why. Hell, I'm 78 years old. What can anybody do to me? I think that speaking up, when you hear these just outrageous kinds of notions about how the world works and how society should is bad and good and all the rest, I might get the nerve to say more things than I do, but don't hold your breath.
Diane Barker. In thinking about insiders and outsiders, I'd just like to remind all of us that this was Kansa Treaty Land. We all know that because of Ron Parks's book, and the maps are there. There are several sections that were Kansa Treaty Land, but this section here in the middle of the state and past Junction City. So the U.S. government made outsiders of the original people.
Hi, I just want to announce that on March 1st at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, the American Civil Liberties Union is offering a training for students on knowing your rights to speak out. And I'll put that information on the coffee and conversation list. But it's a great opportunity to support our students and let them know what they can do and what they should perhaps not do as they encourage their protest.
One last one. I know that we're supposed to cut it off, but
No, we're fine.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm going to take the shot since I'm carrying this thing around. just to remind people that outsiders are what cause movements, so don't be afraid to be one.
Mm-hmm. We've got another 5 minutes.
Your comment about the young student that spoke up that was a drama student. As I dropped Michaela off for her first set building session with the play or musical that she was with all through high school but her freshman year, I started to get out, and then I helped construct the set, and I was complimenting her after we were done about how I was impressed the student stepped up to the plate and grabbed a screwdriver drill or whatever to help, and her response was, well, Dad, they're not normal students. They were the theater group.
Pat Emmers, I just have to say that when I heard Emma, is that the first one of the first students that spoke out? I was truly just blown away. I could not believe what I was hearing. First of all, she was extremely intelligent in the way she sounded like some, you know, really educated, you know, PhD or somebody that just, I mean, I don't know, but I was just struck. And it just felt like the answer was with the youth. I mean, they're the ones that are going to vote in a couple years for these people, and I just really can't wait. I mean, I just can't wait to see what happens. And I just was very struck by that, and and that was the day after it happened. I mean, I heard that, and I just have felt that ever since. So I'm really glad to see how it's caught on and how the youth and have been able to speak out.
Sylvia Beeman. I just like to say that one of the characteristics of outsiders is that they might not be joiners. So there are a lot of people. I find commonality in people that I at first have a knee-jerk reaction against. I just assume they're a certain way. And I work with mostly young people. Actually, all young people. And I've met, I now have friends who are Rastafari, fundamentalist Christian, Muslim. I mean, they're all across the board, and we have very much in common. And sometimes I hesitate to start a conversation, but we share a lot. And I think that you always have to appeal to people's humanity, which we share so much with all people. And And you just have to take that gamble and jump in with people. Like, look at all those kids who spoke out who were thespians. They probably don't all go to the same church, but they found some commonality in an issue. And we just always have to keep trying with people who, and get step out of our little Unitarian box. There are lots of people in this town who don't go here, but we see them other places, and they're outspoken. And I found allies with them in working to try and make the NBAF be safer, and getting Burger King out of my school, and just all kinds of stuff.
Well, thank you all for your comments, and I want to remind you that perseverance doesn't always mean we win. Sometimes we lose, and I want to leave you with words from Margaret Wheatley, that a piece that she calls Fruition. Where does all our hard work get us? What's left when our work hasn't shown any tangible results? When we've failed to achieve anything noteworthy? When we've been disappointed by people, leaders, friends, ideals? What's left is a life of discipline and awareness, where we've exercised choice, served others as best we could, learned as much as we could bear. Such a life yields a rich harvest. The fruits of our labors are not to be found in the world always. They're inside us, in how we feel about ourself, world, life, others. If we rummage around inside ourselves, we might notice that there's less fear than curiosity. We might notice that there's more space, that there's room for choice, that we now contain a larger repertoire of behaviors. We probably will notice that our heart is enlarged, and that even though it takes up a lot more space and demands more attention, it holds good things. The giant emotions of anger, grief, loss, fear now cohabit well together. There's enough room for all, and seldom does any one of them get out of hand. Our big hearts also produce a lot more courage. We've grown unafraid to open ourselves to the dilemmas of the world and to work with them face to face. Perhaps most surprising is our sense of comfort in the world. We've grown to feel we belong here, that life wants us here, that there are more than enough good people to be with and to struggle for. We've lived fully. We've experienced joy, we've had some fun, and we'd do it all over again. So may it be for all of us. Hymn number 143 is our closing hymn, Not in Vain the Distance Beacons.
Hear the war drum call, no longer fear.
Brazilian theologian Ruben Alves, "So let us plant dates, even though we who plant them will never eat them. We may live by the love of what we will never see. This is the secret of discipline."